243-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. When I look back several years over the human rights struggle, or the movement, as some prefer to call it, it seems to me we need to kind of examine where we've been and where we're headed now. I can recall when the school desegregation rulings were hailed as monumental steps, and that was some 15 years ago, and it was very clearly just a beginning. I guess in our age you could say that history has a way of happening to us faster. The human rights struggle has torn cities apart with riots. It has seen black fighting white and white fighting black. It has seen black and white working together in a common cause. And it has seen those same black and whites part company in disagreement. With the coming of militant activists into the black movement, we've seen black fighting with black and black disagreeing with black. Right now, I have a feeling we are momentarily pausing. There's kind of a waiting period while next steps are planned and perhaps a new strategy. What will those next steps be? Are the riots over? Will there be continued progress in human rights under a new administration? Which groups will be the strong new voices? And very importantly, what is the role of the sympathetic white in the future of human rights for the blacks? Tonight I'm privileged to have as my guest on Night Call, Mr. James Forman, who is calling in from New York City. Mr. Forman has been Executive Secretary of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and is now SNCC's Chairman of International Affairs. Mr. Forman has also written a very powerful book. It's called Sammy Young Jr., the first black college student to die in the black liberation movement. Mr. Forman says that the death of Sammy Young marked the end of nonviolence. Mr. Forman, good evening, sir, and thank
good
you for
evening,
being
how are
with
you?
Fine, thank you, and thank you for being with us.
Right.
Mr. Forman, can we begin our Night Call conversation tonight by asking about Sammy Young's death and the change that it caused? Why do you give that offer? Why do you offer that observation?
Well, Sammy Young was killed January 3rd, 1966. At a gas station owned by a white man in Tuskegee, Alabama. And he was shot in the back of the head with a pistol because he was trying to go into a restroom which was not designated for colored based upon the Civil Rights Act of 1965. This is some of the last words that he said, that he had a right to go into the restroom at this gas station. This particular murder was very, very symbolic of many of the murders which had taken place in the past. You know, there have been many people lynched and killed since Reconstruction, some 7,500. And that the murder of Sammy Young on January 3rd, 1966 came after some 7 or 8 or even maybe 10 or 12 years of nonviolent protests. And it culminated the feelings of many people within the human rights struggle that tactical nonviolence itself was no longer applicable because of the many frustrations and the many killings which had preceded Sammy, but his was an apex, apex of disillusionment and a weariness in trying to use tactical nonviolence as a method of struggle within the movement. And for that reason, I think that his death is extremely important. I mean, that's on the broader scale. Within the local situation at Tuskegee, he was killed because he was an uppity nigger in the minds of the whites, because he had been very involved in leadership roles in a situation in Tuskegee, Alabama. And I think that we can see the death of Sammy Young as symbolic, as a reflection of the changing nature of the struggle of black people in this country. After all, it came when black people were being drafted more in the Vietnam War and right after the Watts Rebellion in 65.
Mr. Forman, do we view his death as the end of the peacefulness of the nonviolent movement?
Well, it's, his death is symbolic of that, Dale. I think that that's very correct. And for many of his people, many of his friends, and myself included, as I indicated in the book, that this was just too much and one couldn't take any more. And I think that his death did signal in a very, very real way. The end of tactical nonviolence for many of his friends, many people throughout the South and the country itself.
So would we be wrong in saying that his death was the cause of the movement's turn to violence?
Well, I wouldn't put it in just exactly those words. I would say that his death in many ways represented a very signal change, and I would say also that the any group, you know, that's oppressed as black people are in the United States will ultimately resort to violent means, and the oppression of nonviolence does not work.
Well, when we talk about the change in the tactical movement,
right,
there have been many expressions of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and sometimes some have said a head for a head. But in actuality, not any of the civil rights groups have ever actually come out and accomplished or affected any violence. Is that true?
Well, yeah, that's basically true. I mean, I think that that's true. But on the other hand, the masses of black people in this country have suffered from the violence of whites as their oppressors, you know, for too long, and that people are no longer going to stand by and see such young men as Sammy Young kill without some kind of retribution against the killers.
But is it the groups that are doing it, is it the individuals?
Well, yeah, well, I wouldn't, I mean, none of the major civil rights groups in this country have come out with a program of retribution and a program of aggressive violence. That doesn't mean that people within these groups do not necessarily share certain opinions. But I think that we have to think not in terms of the groups, but we have to think in terms of what black people themselves are thinking and what moves that they are prepared to make, and not concentrate just on the groups. Do you understand the distinction that I'm trying to make?
I may be a little bit in the gray area, because I'm thinking that if the groups speak for most of the people, that it is with the groups that, quote unquote, the establishment has to work with.
Well, I don't think that the civil rights groups, by and large, speak for most of black people in this country, and I don't think they ever have, as a matter of fact, because I think that most black people, by and large, have never accepted tactical nonviolence as a method of change inside the United States. I mean, I've said this some 9 or 10 years, as a matter of fact, and of course it's really true. Because many people simply accepted, you know, tactical nonviolence as a tactic and wished those people employing it very well, but they were not prepared to do it themselves. And I think that this is a fundamental distinction which has not often been made. We've been trying to pinpoint the so-called civil rights groups, the human rights groups, as being representative of black people in this country, and that's just not the case.
Well, what has happened when we've looked around and we've seen that Washington has invited a number of prominent, quote-unquote, against spokesmen who are generally regarded as leaders who represent certain groups, and they're brought in and there are discussions and programs are discussed, and we assume that as a result of these meetings, as a result of these conferences, that the establishment in Washington or the people in Washington are talking to all of the people or all of the black people. Now, there seems to be some controversy here.
Well, that's never been the case. I mean, because they, for instance, there were many times, you know, there have been many times when there have been conferences at the White House where SNCC as an organization has never been represented, and SNCC has never tried to claim that it speaks for the masses of those people who have been left out of the White House. And I think that what you're talking about is that the administration, the white power structure, by and large, has tried to select a few black people to represent and act as spokesmen for the masses of black people. And that's the case. I mean, and that's going to be further be the case. I mean, the people that they have there don't represent, by and large, you know, the masses of black people. And I think that one of the things that I tried to point out in the book on Sammy Young was that a lot of the leadership, you know, which was titular leadership, did not represent, you know, the interests of the student groups at Tuskegee or in Alabama or the Deep South, for instance.
Are we saying now that nonviolence is out, that we cannot accomplish anything by nonviolence?
Yes, I mean, tactical nonviolence. Nonviolence is definitely out. That doesn't mean that people can't have demonstrations and can't have picket lines, but, you know, it is inconceivable that one could think of mass demonstrations as one has had in the past, where tactical nonviolence was employed, where black people were beaten by whites as a tactic, deliberately, you know, suffering those kinds of injustices. That day is over. I mean, there will be incidents, but it's a phase, you know, it's a lingering phase. And that's why I think that, you know, Sammy Young is symbolic of that particular change. And it came at a time when that change was occurring. And I've tried to go into what were some of the reasons for that change. And I think that as you read the book and as you understand what was the motivation and what were the aspirations of Sammy Young, you'll see where this is the case. After all, here was a man who served for 2 years in the United States Navy on the USS Independence, blockading the coast of Cuba, came back inside the United States and was shot and killed, you know, by people that he was trying to protect.
Can we trace for just a moment up until the death of Sammy Young, the work of the movement? Now, I'm going to refer for just a moment to the, we're going to discuss your book as well, but Bill Kunstler's book, Deep in My Heart, where he states, and I'm quoting, he says, in essence, King, and speaking of course of Dr. King, saw his role as the architect of dramatic confrontations with local white power structures, the purpose of which was to rouse the national conscience. Foreman, on the other hand, and of course referring to you, sought the emergence of indigenous Negro leadership and the development of political organization in local communities. Now, could you kind of break that down for us?
Well, I think that that's a correct assessment, and I think that it has to be broader than just myself. That is that, you know, the organization that I work with, SNCC, was very concerned about developing indigenous leadership, local leadership, such people as Sammy Young Jr., for instance. That was part of our program, to go into a community to try to find people who were not involved in the movement, to get them involved and to develop them as a leader, because we felt that we needed mass leadership in this country. You know, Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown was a reflection of this kind of an attempt on the part of the organization. Mrs. Hamer in Mississippi is another. Whereas SCLC was a very much a leader-oriented organization. By that I mean that Dr. King was considered the leader of SCLC, and that they attempted to go into communities and to use the prestige and the leadership of Dr. King in order to confront America on a massive scale and to see the frustrations of the society through the experiences of Dr. King in particular. Is that clear? If not, I can break it down a little bit more. I mean, for instance, I mean, you know, you trace the developments, you know, of Dr. King's life, for instance, the Montgomery bus boycott, the Albany demonstrations, the Birmingham demonstrations. These things were centered around his own charisma, that is, his own personality by and large. And there wasn't a massive attempt on the part of his organization to develop local leadership, whereas we were concerned with developing political bases throughout the Deep South and developing this leadership which could emerge and go, you know, carry forth, and that we ourselves were extremely unimportant as individuals.
Now, both schools of philosophy or both programs up to this point were nonviolent.
There's a difference. You see, because SNCC as an organization always used nonviolence as a tactic. I mean, we never believed in nonviolence as a total way of life. For instance, myself and many other people understood that if we were in a different setting, we would probably be involved with revolutionary violence. Dr. King believed in nonviolence as a dogma, as a total way of life, and there could be no deviations. Of course, he was hypocritical in that, in the sense that he was willing to call out the National Guards to suppress the rebellions that were occurring in the cities, and that he was willing for the federal government to use, you know, violence against black people, and so that there was a big contradiction in his total commitment to nonviolence.
You've lost me again. You said he was willing.
Yes, he was willing. Not only was he willing in 67, I mean, he signed a statement saying that the, you know, federal troops should be used in the cities where there were rebellions. And so, in other words, he was not completely committed to nonviolence as a way of life, because he never would have advocated the use of troops to put down the rebellions which black people were engaged in.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation, The Evolution of the Black Movement, and our guest tonight is Mr. James Forman. We'll return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest James Forman after station identification. Call it a social pressure valve, the voice of the ghetto, the voice of disgust, the voice of hope. Call it what you will, it's the voice of the people. Night Call lets people talk, and experts on the phone anywhere in the country or in the world offer answers to some of the problems. Having a heart-to-heart squawk, at least it gets people talking, first about their problems and eventually to each other. Night Call has a potential cast of 200 million Americans, and we are now on 90 stations in 84 cities. It could just be the most important listening post on the air today, because it starts people talking. A program you should listen to, a forum to speak for yourself. If we don't start talking to each other, we'll end up shouting, and there's no telling where we'll wind up after that. Night Call, every weeknight on this station. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest James Forman about the evolution of the Black Liberation Movement in the United States and in the world. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. James Forman, and there are a number of other areas we want to go into, plus clarification on a couple of issues, but we don't want to hold up our Night Call listeners, so we'll try to kind of blend in with the other listeners. So we'll take our first call tonight from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mrs. Pickett is here in Night Call over WTMJ. Mrs. Pickett?
Yes.
Good evening.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I praise your program very highly. I listen to it regularly, and you talk about things that are very important and really need to be aired. So congratulations to all concerned.
And we thank you very much, ma'am.
You're welcome. And the second thing I want to say is that James Forman, I don't know about the other listeners, but James Forman was a little bit confused in my mind with James Farmer. And I like to say that to anyone listening, that they are two different men, although they're both in the civil rights movement.
Thank you for clearing up the distinction, because there is one.
Yes. Well, now, I'm not sure that I'm not really on my toes with everything, and there's so many things going on, it's quite hard for everyone to be informed about everything. But as I understand it, you are associated with SNCC.
Right.
And SNCC is very closely allied with the Southern Christian Movement, of which Dr. Martin Luther King was the king, the exemplar, whatever you want to call him, the leader. Right?
Right. Well, yes, in part, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to say this at the very outset of the program, but I'm very much aware of an opposing kind of thinking among black people in the fight of the black movement, if that's the right term for it. And that is the people who are thinking along the lines of Mr. Cleaver and the Black Panthers. And I wonder if your movement is gaining strength. My question is this: is your movement gaining strength, and do you think that your movement will be able to outpower the people who are the followers of Eldridge Cleaver?
Well, first, I think we need some clarification
right
here.
Right.
Mr. Forman being our guest tonight, we've invited him to help us to trace the evolution of the movement. Now, before we even gotten into this, right away there's the question is being posed as to which movement is going to win, and I don't think that is it. Whatever Mr. Cleaver's philosophy, this is only one part of the total movement. And I think before, if Mr. Foreman can answer, but I hope Mr. Foreman will kind of give us a little background leading up to this, because I think it's very easy for people to talk in terms of what is happening today without actually knowing what brought us to this point.
Okay, fine, Dell.
Okay.
Now, I mean, in the first place, it's true that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference held, first of all, a conference out of which SNCC grew. They were two different organizations. One of the key differences, there were two key differences. One is that SNCC always used nonviolence as a tactic, whereas I said that Southern Christian Leadership Conference believed in it as a way of life. The second one was in the method of organizing, which we've already discussed. Now, SNCC has no ideological disagreements, by and large, with the Black Panther Party, because we have worked very much to promote Black Panther parties throughout this country, and one of the things that happened, as I indicate in the book on Sammy Young, was that Sammy himself was very influential in developing the Black Panther Party back in Alabama in 65. That was prior to the creation of the Black Panther Party in California. And the Black Panther Party of California has to be seen as a logical extension of the activities of SNCC as an organization, which created the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in Alabama with the Black Panther Party as a symbol. And we went around the country trying to promote this on other levels. And one of the most outstanding successes has been the Black Panther Party in California, which we were not directly involved with the organization, but we have been involved to some extent with its organizing. I once held a position in that particular organization. So now, the key thing is that there is very little ideological disagreement between the Black Panther Party, of which Eldridge Cleaver is only one officer, and SNCC as an organization. And I think that the key thing is not to say which will win out, but the question is how will black people inside the United States gain their liberation and end the kind of oppression which they suffer as a colonized people in this country? And I make no distinction that I don't think that the philosophy of nonviolence as a way of life is going to lead to that liberation of our people.
Well, when we talk about the Black Panther Party, most people, I would assume, have been somewhat carried away by the headlines and the incidents, of course, that took place in California. Is it possible, Mr. Foreman, for you to give us some idea of what the Black Panthers Party actually stands for?
Well, that's a very long, question. Black Panther Party has a statement of goals and objectives, for the liberation of black people inside the United States, just as SNCC as an organization has it too. And both of these organizations believe, that there has to be, revolution inside the United States before there can be, total freedom of our people. I think it would be too long for me to give any more than that.
There's no vying for power here between the organizations, as I get it. You're working together, right? I didn't think so, but are you saying that they're working together?
Are you talking about the Black Panther Party and SNCC as an organization?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, there's no vying for power between us. Because we feel that, the concept of revolution inside the United States is extremely valid. We're two different organizations, as there are thousands of other organizations inside the United States.
Where there is, are all of the civil rights groups today, are they all tied in ideologically?
Well, no, they're not, Dell. SNCC as an organization, first of all, no longer considers itself a civil rights organization. In June 1967, we clarified that and called ourselves a human rights organization. We are in opposition as an organization to many of the principles and tactics of the Urban League, of the NAACP, for example, even of CORE and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So they're not all tied in. And I think that to expect that these organizations will all have the same goal and the same ideological framework is a mistake within the framework of capitalism under which we live.
Well, you brought up another word. You said capitalism.
Yes.
That brings to mind the new administration that's going in. Do you think that your organization will be able to progress as rapidly under a new administration as under the Republican incoming administration as it has under the outgoing one?
Well, I don't know. I mean, one of the things that, the new administration is going to try to promote black capitalism among black people. We do not feel that this is a solution to the problems of our people, because we must see capitalism as a principal enemy of black people, not only in this country, but of colored people in the third world. And that we have to make this very clear distinction that we have three principal enemies: racism, capitalism, and imperialism. What we expect under the new administration is an extreme amount of repression. Already the Attorney General is talking about using new electronic devices and so forth, you know, against what they call crime, but that's in fact against black people in the United States.
Mrs. Pickett, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Really. We'll take our next call from New York locally. Mrs. Workman is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Workman?
Yes, Mr. Shield.
Good evening, ma'am.
And Mr. Foreman, my question is, or my statement, we've been divided so many ways, like the NAACP Corps, they served their purpose, you know, and now in 69 we have to take, like, different steps to progress. How would you think about forming, or the idea, of course, had come up of forming a black caucus, you know, to divide leaderships instead of, like, saying our programs are different, but our ideology, of course, is the same, and that's for the benefit of the black people?
Well, that's just not sufficient to say that our ideology is the same. I mean, we have to make sure that, in fact, our ideology is the same. SNCC as an organization has a very clear ideological point of view that we see racism, capitalism, and imperialism as a principal enemy of black people in the United States and colored people throughout the world.
Right.
Every black person in this country does not subscribe to that, and in fact, many people in so-called civil rights organizations are striving to be black capitalists, and we see them as much as a part of the enemy as Rockefeller. So that the cry for black unity is a false cry if it's not geared ideologically to a fight against racism, capitalism, and imperialism.
But it's almost impossible to have the same, you know, it can be closely related, you know, but it's almost impossible to have the same ideas strongly. So what do? They serve their purpose in the movement of the black people, as well as so many other people that have died before them. They will serve their purpose, and after that, you know, maybe during that time, like people would learn, you know, the meaning of unity and not capitalism, you know, which is also outdated.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not sure that I understand all of what you're saying, but like I try to point out in this book on Sammy Young, I mean, he tried as a leader in Tuskegee to bring about a tremendous amount of unity in Tuskegee, Alabama itself. But Sammy Young Jr. and his fellow workers were incapable of bringing about unity with a middle class that saw itself and even in opposition against the civil rights movement itself, not let alone a fight against capitalism.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling. Mr. Foreman, can we view the philosophy of SNCC as the attempt to present a different political philosophy? And is there a difference between the political philosophy and the political program as opposed to the ideology?
Well, I think that that's a correct assessment. No, ideological framework we're trying to advance, we feel, is important for a long-range fight and for the salvation of our people. I mean, this thing is going to be going on way beyond my lifetime and so forth. And that it is necessary, you know, for black leadership to correctly analyze and say to the masses of black people in this country what, in fact, and who are the enemies. And in response to the last question, you build unity around an ideological approach. I mean, it is a false sense of unity to feel that just because we're all black, we can unite. I mean, because we have some of the most vehement opposition that we face as an organization come from some of the so-called established black leaders. And that's what Sammy Young faced in Tuskegee.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation, The Evolution of the Black Movement, our guest, Mr. James Foreman, who was the executive secretary of SNCC and is now SNCC's chairman of international affairs. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Foreman, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest James Foreman after station identification. Next week on Night Call, Del Shields with his guests, a political analyst who calls Richard Nixon the incredibly durable ghost from another time. A white citizen of Wilmington, Delaware, who along with the mayor protests the occupation of the ghetto areas by National Guard troops since last April. The Eastern director of SNCC, who's just made an international tour on black power as an international concept. A close observer of Cuban affairs just returned from Havana, and the black woman who defended George Wallace's right to free speech. Monday, inauguration night. Del Shields' guest is the political analyst for Harper's Magazine, Larry King. Tuesday, a white citizen of Wilmington, Delaware, Peter Hughes. Wednesday, a SNCC executive, Irving Davis, on black power as an international concept. Thursday, Cuba as it really is today, with Jose Iglesias. Friday, black woman lawyer Eleanor Norton on free speech at any price. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest James Foreman about the evolution of the black liberation movement in the United States and in the world. All Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. James Foreman. And Mr. Foreman, if my interpretation is correct, you have stated to us that the civil rights organizations are not united by a common ideology. So in this period of assessment, as we look at 1969, I'm assuming that we can look forward to seeing different directions or perhaps a reevaluation of the whole civil rights movement. Am I right in that?
Oh, yeah, I think that that's very true. And I think that the in many instances, we may as well stop using the term civil rights organization because I think that, you know, that term is no longer applicable to the kind of struggle that we have to put up in this country.
Well, can we talk for just a moment about the tactical philosophy? When people read about various spokesmen, and I'm not necessarily saying that they represent any particular faction, but we hear or when we read a various spokesman saying that they no longer subscribe to the philosophy of nonviolence, exactly what does this mean?
Well, it means several different things. One of the things that it means that after the murder of a young man like Sammy Young Jr. in Tuskegee Institute, it is absolutely foolish to feel that the students at Tuskegee, that black people throughout the United States, are going to engage in massive demonstrations where they allow themselves to be attacked by whites as people did in the early stages of the civil rights movement. And the right of self-defense is, you know, one of the things that many people have talked about around this country, but which became real to the, you know, friends of Sammy Young Jr. Then secondly, I mean, that's important. And secondly is that you can't, in the long range of history, you know, build kind of revolutionary struggle necessary, you know, to change, you know, the political and economic structure of this country on the philosophy of nonviolence.
Now,
those are the two things.
Right now, is the movement going through a period of segregation rather than integration?
Well, I think that the terms separation, integration, segregation, or integration are irrelevant terms and, you know, should not necessarily be used. I think what the movement is going through is a growing recognition that the right of revolution is the only right that black people must be concerned with. And, of course, I mean, we can always appeal to the Declaration of Independence if we need to appeal to that, you know, for that particular right. I mean, when any group is oppressed like black people in this country. And so that I think that, you know, I think that those terms, segregation and integration, we should also just throw out of the window. I mean, people are groping for how to deal with their conditions as black people in this country.
We'll take our next call from Niagara Falls, New York. Mr. White is hearing Night Call over WBFO-FM. Mr. White?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Forum?
Yes.
I have two questions for you. I'm a counselor at a community college with actually very few black people. Now, I see things at a different, I have different kinds of concerns. Now, the first question is, assuming there is no qualified black person available, do you think under any circumstances a sensitive white person could teach a course in Afro-American history? And we want to get that kind of information across. And the second question is, do you think a white person can't ever understand what it's like being black and young in America? And if you do agree, as a possibility, what kinds of experiences do you think he should have to understand?
Okay, in answer to the first question, there are many, quote, qualified, unquote, black people, you know, in the United States who could, you know, teach these courses. And I think that what educational institutions have to do is to go out and search for these people and to get them involved within the whole teaching profession. I mean, that would be one answer that I would give. Now, on the other hand, it is quite possible that there can be some kind of teaching by a white person of Afro-American history, but this should never have to happen if the educational institutions do not take a racist attitude and do not try to perpetuate the mental violence on all people in this country. And let me explain what I'm saying. I mean, most people are miseducated in this country, and they get miseducated certainly by not having the teaching of Afro-American history. So that educational institutions, in summary, can go out and find qualified black people. That's what I think. The second thing is it is impossible for a white person to understand the conditions of black people in this country. I mean, for instance, nobody could understand a lot of the things that Sammy Young went through. I hope that in presenting this particular book on him, that more and more people will begin to have a better awareness and understanding of what his life was in Tuskegee. But that doesn't mean because people cannot totally understand the lives and sufferings of such people as Sammy Young that they can't empathize. Otherwise, there would be no point in my writing the book, because part of the reasons for writing the book was to present a documentary history of his life and to get more and more people aware of it, black as well as white. So now I think that the key thing that whites have to be concerned with is the kind of mental rape that this country imposes upon all people, the kind of mental violence which it perpetuates against all people in the United States, and understand very thoroughly, you know, that you have a few rulers in this country who are financiers, bankers, politicians, who are exploiting not only people in the United States, but throughout the whole world.
One more thing. Assuming a kind of attitude that on the part of a faculty where you would hire a white person to teach Afro-American history, do you think in any way he could compensate for this by adding black people as resource people to the courses, teaching the units on that basis?
Well, fine. If you can add black people as resource people, they can also teach the course, and the white can provide certain resources.
Yeah, it's a kind of catalyst to get the thing started and going from there to get the blackness of the
situation. Yeah, but you see, that's a part of the racist attitude which exists throughout the country. If you can find black resource people, every black person who's a resource individual probably has the ability to communicate. That what I'm saying is he can talk. And if he can talk to the teacher as a resource person, he can talk to the class, so employ him as the teacher.
Right. Now, one more thing. Isn't there a hope, though, that our humanity, our common humanity, can bring about the kinds of understandings that will lead to a good solution to this problem, not involving a kind of violence, but where sensitive people are disseminating and pushing for experiences that bring people together? In other words, when a person experiences discrimination, it could be because of blackness and it could be because of shortness, but sometimes the emotional reaction is the same. It's a sort of a conspiracy against his humanity.
Oh, well, that's very true. I mean, that part of it is true. Certainly, the one of the things that I tried to do in my book on Sammy Young was to show his total humanity insofar as I could do that. And certainly there's a tremendous amount of identification with his life which can be had by anybody who understands suffering. And I think that that's the same thing you're saying, right?
Right, that is. Very good. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. Mr. Foreman, is there a place for white people in the movement?
Well, the, you know, in the life of Sammy Young, there was a tremendous amount of activity on the parts of whites in certain phases of the demonstrations. There was a white student, for instance, who was beaten at a church, and that's described in the book. There is a place in a revolutionary movement for whites. There's no question about that, because the foundations of racism exist within the white community, and exploitation, you know, which is practiced throughout the country reaches all people. So that that's very important. Now, this question, you know, usually has been confused, you know, by the press of the United States and deliberately by a lot of people who run the country, because what they're trying to do is perpetuate a feeling on the part of whites, naturally, that they're superior to black people. But whites themselves have to understand how they are raped mentally, how they're exploited in the United States, and must work for revolutionary change inside this country. So certainly there's a place.
We'll take our next call from Louisville, Kentucky. Mr. Meyer is hearing Night Call over WLRS. Mr. Meyer?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Foreman, please.
Yes.
Are you a communist?
Are you?
I beg your pardon?
Are you?
No, sir.
I see.
I was interested in knowing whether you are a member of the Communist Party or if you're an ideological communist. The reason I ask, you talk like one.
Well, let me deal with that question by saying this, that one of the ways that this country, you know, tries to stop change is by trying to label people communists. And
well, no, I'm not trying to label you.
Just a moment. You are trying to label me that by asking me that question. Wait just a minute.
Okay.
I mean, if you want, what you should be dealing with are the ideas that I present. And that one of the things that has definitely happened throughout this country and has been perpetuated and will keep getting perpetuated in this country is that anybody who challenges the status quo of this country and tells the correct facts about exploitation and racism inside this country will be labeled a communist. Now, this label does not frighten me. I don't care.
I'm not trying to label you, but...
I mean, you are trying to label me by raising the question.
I've read Marxist-Leninism, and you follow the line.
Well, you know, if that is the case, then that is the case.
I wondered what kind of revolution you're trying to wage in this country. It seems to me like if you're in so much bondage that it's amazing that you're so free to talk. You're invited on this radio station, and I wonder about your source of income. Now, you talk about the Rockefellers. I've heard you get pretty rough on the white race.
Mr. Meyer, you're using the standard tactic. Now, we have a program of dialogue. And we're dealing with ideas, and I think that Mr. Foreman's income or how he makes his money, I think it's his private prerogative.
Well,
now, now just a moment, sir. Now, you know, you call quite regularly, and we try to be very courteous, and we don't always agree with you. But if we're going to talk about ideas, and if you disagree with the ideas, fine, but let's take it out of its personal vendetta bag. You know, it's very easy to just wipe away a man, you know, by using the stock phrases, and I don't think that's necessary here.
Okay, is it permissible to quote Mr. Foreman and ask him to comment to that, respond to the quote?
All right.
You were quoted as having said at the Conference of New Politics in Chicago, "We blacks and we alone have the responsibility to wage our war of liberation as we see fit. No one, absolutely no one in the world or the United States has the right to dictate to us the forms of our struggle. We insist on our right to define the manner in which we will fight our aggressors. It is our right, our responsibility, and anyone who doesn't like it can go to hell."
Well, that's true. I mean, I said that and I still mean that.
Uh-huh. You made quite a few more very inflammatory statements from time to time, and it seems that so many of the people involved with your movement go to Cuba from time to time. They are connected in so many cases with people whose communist background certainly is not even contestable. I mean, there's no question about it, and I can't understand why.
In other words, you're trying to guilt by association, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Foreman, may I ask this? Mr. Meyer, just a moment. Mr. Foreman, would you define for us what the war is?
Yes, what kind of war or liberation is this? What are you trying to do? What do you hope to accomplish in America?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is to build a humane society where people will not go around necessarily trying to label people, trying to smear them, where such organizations as the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan does not kill people as Sammy Young was killed in Tuskegee, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to eliminate the kind of poverty and oppression which has been practiced against black people in this country ever since 1609 and to build a humane society where such people, again, I repeat, as Sammy Young Jr., will not be killed at the age of 21 by a white gas station attendant operating a Standard Oil station, which is owned by the Rockefellers.
Well, it seems to me like the Rockefeller Foundations have given an awful lot of money to organizations such as yours. Why is this?
Well, that's not true, but anyway.
Well, I say, if you want to hold the phone a minute, I'll get a book with some references in it.
Mr. Meyer, we want to thank you very much for calling, sir.
All right, thank you.
This is Night Call in New York. Our guest tonight is Mr. James Foreman. We'll return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest James Foreman after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, what's happening on Capitol Hill? In less than a week, Richard Nixon will be in the White House and a new administration will have begun. Last week, the new 91st Congress met for its first session. What will these changes in administration mean for America? What are the people like who will conduct the destiny of this nation? Our guest, one of Washington's foremost political reporters, Drew Pearson, knows what it's really like in the nation's capital. Over the years, his exposés have led to investigations, dismissals, and general house cleaning in every level of U.S. government. What's happening on Capitol Hill with the reporter whose column, some say, exerts the greatest influence on the nation, Drew Pearson, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest James Foreman about the evolution of the Black Liberation Movement in the United States and in the world. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
We'll take our next call from Savannah, Georgia. Mr. Gardner is here at Night Call over WSOK. Mr. Gardner?
Thank you, Del.
From Savannah, Georgia.
Mr. Gardner, would you be kind enough to turn your radio down, sir?
Yes, we'll be turning it down. I think we have a feedback.
Well, if you turn it off...
Mr. Former, will you please evaluate the differences of opinion when it comes to violence or nonviolence of the black man, as well as the white man, of the North, in contrast to the black man and white man of the South? And whatever you favor, give me some kind of a summary that would allow the people of the South, be them black or white, to understand your application insofar as your particular organization is concerned.
Well, Mr. Gardner, first I'm going to ask if you'll turn your radio off because we can still hear it and it's interfering with our lines here.
Hello?
Mr. Gardner? Hello?
Yes, hello?
Yes, Mr. Gardner, did you turn your radio off?
Yes, we did.
Right, okay. Mr. Foreman, the question isn't clear to me.
Yeah, well, look. I don't think that there's any distinction between the violence which this country perpetuates against black people in the North or the South. I mean, the situation at Chicago, for instance, in 1968 should have been a clear example. I mean, there have been many instances throughout this country in northern areas where... a new form of lynching has been practiced against black people. The violence, southern whites against blacks, I mean, is only different in maybe sometimes form. And I think it's a mistake to try to separate the country north and south in terms of the violence which is perpetuated against black people. I mean, again, I have to keep referring to my book, Sammy Young Jr., as an example the kind of violence which was perpetuated in a town called Tuskegee. Now, what is different about that is that Sammy Young's murderer was acquitted by an all-white jury, And I would suspect that in certain northern areas there would at least be a trial, although he might easily be acquitted, and that there may be some substantive degree in the nature of the court. But I don't think that we can make a distinction between the violence which is perpetuated either north or south. And as far as nonviolence, I think that throughout the country, and again, I refer to this book, Samuel Young Jr., and I hope some of these people will read the book, and a lot of this will become clear, it seems to me, that the people in the South and people in the North, you know, saw this murder as a symbolic or as change and a necessity not to employ nonviolence. That's the best I can answer the question, Dale.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Gardner?
Yes, sir, Mr. Shields. I'd like to, when I think in terms of the plight of the minority group, I'd like to also ask Mr. Farmer, are we in total agreement with the issues of, the black American, when we think in terms of the North, the Northern American, as well as the Southern American? This is really the point I'm trying to get to.
Well, when you say we, who are the we?
Well, when I say we, I'm considering myself as a Southerner, and I'm a black American. And I think in terms of the Northern American thinking is somewhat different from the black American of the South.
Yeah, well, I don't think, look, man, I've lived all over this country. I was raised in Mississippi, and I think that we are trying, I mean, that perpetuates a false division if we try to see our problems as separate. One of the things that was important about the activities of Sammy Young, that he participated in civil rights demonstrations, and with the passing of the 65 Civil Rights Act, the problems of black people across this country were equalized. Now, people try to perpetuate a myth of Southerners against Northerners, but as black people in this country, we have to see our problems as one and related to the problems of oppressed people throughout the world.
All right. Being quite in agreement with you, is this a fact? I mean, when I say this, I think in terms of the various organizations in civil rights, I think in terms of the organizations of the North, in contrast with organizations of the South. I think you mentioned earlier that Dr. Martin Luther King, although he in part did such a magnificent job in civil rights and nonviolence, but he had never developed the leadership to carry on. And I don't want to misquote you, but I think I understood you to say something to that extent.
Well, I think Mr. Foreman at the top of the program attempted to point out that not all of the civil rights groups as we know them represent the interests of all black people. I think that he kind of cleared it up very beautifully. And one of the problems that we see is that when you look at the white population is represented by thousands of groups with thousands of interests. But yet when it comes to black people, we normally think or ordinarily think that one group or two or three groups represents the interests of 22 million blacks. And this is not true. See, the blacks were never asked who were their leaders. This is what you have to remember.
Not only were they not asked, but people like Sammy Young, Dale, I mean, were repudiated by local leadership in Tuskegee, Alabama. Gomillion, for instance, who had the Tuskegee Civic Association, and this is well documented again in the book, you know, talks about the need to have whites and blacks in the government, whereas Sammy and his contemporaries were talking about all black governments in a county where black people were are 85% of the population.
Well, Mr. Foreman, may I ask this, possibly in line with Mr. Gardner's question, the fact that in 1969 that there can be open disagreement or open disagreement of opinion in terms of the ideology or in terms of the movement, do you see this as black people maturing, or do you see it as the differences sharpening?
No, I see this as a maturity factor.
Who is speaking?
This is why I say this, and this is why I ask the question of the Northern black and white as well as the Southern black and white. I see all humanity, regardless of race.
I'm sorry, Dale, did you ask me?
Yes, I asked you. I was just trying to be courteous to my listeners.
Right, oh, I'm sorry. No. I just didn't want anybody to think that I was answering.
No. All right, well, Mr. Gardner, let's ask Mr. Foreman to answer.
Okay, well, no, I see it as a maturing and also a sharpening of, of the ideological struggle which has to be waged.
Right, I agree with you there. What I was really trying to arrive at some sanity in my understanding of the issue, that some organizations in civil rights came into existence in the North with Northern problems. Other organizations came into existence in the South with Southern problems. And the two meeting each other at a pinpoint created another kind of a problem. I think this is where the confusion come in. I think this is where militancy and non-militancy come in. I don't know. This is why I called, to get some more understanding.
I don't agree with that theory at all, but Mr. Foreman, Mr. Gardner, thank you very much for calling. We'll ask Mr. Foreman to kind of sum it up for us in the closing moments. Thank you, sir.
Well, right. The summary that I would make, Dale, is that... And I'm paraphrasing much of, what I say in my opening chapter in Sammy Young, is that his death represented a turning point, symbolized a turning point in the civil rights movement, and was sort of like a death nail even to the phrase of civil rights movement, where people, began to reject the concept of tactical nonviolence as a method of struggle, where also the differences between civil rights organizations came to the forefront, and in fact, the antagonisms within the black community were extremely sharp, as they're getting sharper throughout the United States, and that we cannot expect a cry of unity just around the question of blackness to be sufficient, because there are many class factors which enter in, and many people are beginning to prepare for a long-range struggle where we see the enemy as racism, capitalism, and imperialism, and we will try to unite people around that common ideological framework.
Mr. Foreman, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, What's Happening on Capitol Hill with columnist Drew Pearson. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.